Now here with me is Larry Augustine. He is founder and chairman of Sugar CRM.
So I'm CEO.
CEO.
I'm not the founder. The founders were Clint Oram, Jacob Taylor, and John Roberts. I joined as CEO about a year ago now. I've been involved with the company for 4 to 5 years. I was an early investor in the company, and I've been on the board of directors. And I came in as CEO about a year ago now.
But you founded other companies?
I was the founder of VA Linux, CEO there, and that's a company I took public in 1999.
And now it's called?
Now it's called GeekNet.
Yeah, and before?
So SourceForge.
Yeah, SourceForge. Yeah. Maybe so, the name people...
Yeah, so one of the things I'm known for is helping create SourceForge.net. Yeah. In fact, I just saw a person walking past right behind us here, a gentleman by the name of Chris DeBona, that you may know. And Chris used to work for me, and Chris, constantly reminds me that he was deeply involved in the creation of SourceForge.net when he worked for us. I think he takes credit for that name in particular, SourceForge.
but why now is it called GeekNet?
I don't know. I've been gone for a while. I don't know why they changed the name. It's an interesting story there. Originally, I had the vision for SourceForge because I was working with some free software and had found a bug. In this case, it was particularly a version of Bash, the born-again shell, that had a bug in it. And I went to grab the source code to track down and take a look at where the bug was. And when I went to grab the source code, I realized that I didn't have the source package for the binary I was running and started looking for that particular source code and realized I actually had a problem finding the source code for that package because you have to understand this was at a time when version control in terms of public repositories, we didn't have Subversion, we didn't have JIT. We had sort of RCS, and version control wasn't published on the web, and so people just put up a tarball with the source code or tarballs for the binaries built for particular Linux distros. And in this case, I was running probably a Slackware distro, and I was looking at the source code. And I realized I had a hard time finding the source code for the particular versions of the binaries I was running. And it was because people would just put up the new version of the source code, and they'd overwrite the old one. And I realized, we have the potential here to lose a lot of information about the code we're creating, the sort of history of development there. And I was worried that we were creating software that we were losing. It was too easy for digital artifacts to be lost. And in fact, about the same time, we were engaged as a community in a project to find all the old releases of Linux, which today we just sort of think of as an easy thing, but then Linus didn't keep old versions of Linux.
Yeah,
he wasn't using source code control, and he said why.
Oh, yeah.
And sort of his comment was, well, how I do backups? I publish the code on the internet, and everyone downloads it, puts it on their sites as well. That was that. That's which makes sense in some funny way, right? But we were engaged in a project to actually go back and find every single version of Linux ever released, and people were having to go back to archives and tape, dumps and try and find old versions to assemble the complete history of Linux. And so I said, this is not a problem we should have. And I did a quick calculation. I looked at I went to Fresh Meat. If you're familiar with Fresh Meat, the website where... much of the software that's released open source is announced, or at least was at the time. I went and looked at the Fresh Meat logs and realized that the amount of software released in source code form each year corresponded to about the same size as the largest commodity disk drive you could buy. And that there was, in fact, a pattern here. And I looked at this, I said, gee, why do we delete anything? What we need to do is create a permanent archive of all the open software released on the internet. And so I launched a project internally at VA Linux called Cold Storage. And that was the code name for the project. We had T-shirts made up, and a handful of those Cold Storage T-shirts are out there, right? And the idea was that we would take everything that was announced on Fresh Meat and put it in cold storage. Sort of the pun there, fresh meat into cold storage. You preserve it that way and you keep it. Anyway, pun's lost on some people, but that's how we launched the project. We originally started building it. We put a team of people together, and that idea, that team, ended up producing SourceForge. And it took us about 90 days to build the first version. We launched it in late fall. We launched it around in November, end of November, around the Thanksgiving holiday in the U.S. It was around Thanksgiving, November 1999. And the response was just phenomenal. I mean, we were solving an immense set of problems at the time for open source projects, which is, give me a website, you know, give me a place to put up a code tree, a CVS, you know, repository, give me mailing lists, give me discussion forums, things that, quite frankly, we take, you know, for granted now. And I was mentioning Chris DeBona earlier. Chris over has done a lot of that to help out the community now with what he's done at Google Code, as another example of a site that does that. But you know, at the time, it was it was something pretty new in terms of the concept. Now we know what concepts of forges are, and we think about them.
When you started with open source, I think you were a student. Is that right?
Yes, I was. Sort of my first, you know, real exposure to open source was as a graduate student at Stanford University. So I had, as an undergraduate, I didn't work with open source a lot, but I was lucky enough to go to get, so I was an undergraduate at Notre Dame, went to get my master's at Stanford, and was in computer-aided design tools. And the interesting thing was all the interesting computer-aided design tools at the time, all of them were available in under the BSD license. Right, as because of the university, UC Berkeley was a big producer of those computer-aided design tools, and these were the leading tools of the time. So they were available under a BSD license, and that was normally the way you interacted with the software. And this was around 1984, 85, and I went from there, and so that was sort of my first exposure. And all of the development and effort we put into computer-aided design tools was done around what was then free software. It's before the term open source existed, right? Free software, typically BSD licensed. And the interesting thing was, we didn't use that software because we couldn't afford commercial alternatives. At the university, particularly at Stanford, we had access to everything we wanted to have access to.
Enough money.
It wasn't a question of money. People would give us what we needed, right? Mm-hmm. We used free software, open source, because it was better software, right? That was fundamentally it. At one point, I was working, as I was finishing my degree there, I was working as doing some CAD tool development and working as a system administrator at a startup. And we used to build everything on Sun workstations. That was the standard development platform, okay? Now, the interesting thing about that was, as soon as we get a Sun machine, the first thing we do is overwrite a lot of the software that came from Sun with software we downloaded off the internet for free. Uh-huh. So we built everything with the GNU compiler toolchain. Why? It wasn't that it was free, is it was better, right? We would, the Sun machines would ship with a version of the X Window system installed. We would download the MIT released version and install that over top of what came from Sun. Why? It actually was faster and better than what they would ship, because whatever they would ship was the MIT X Window system from 6 months ago. So they were 6 months out of a date, out of a piece of software that was evolving very rapidly. And so we got the latest version from MIT. And that was typical. I mean, those are just a couple examples, but all of the code and software and tools we use, what was available open source was better than what we were getting commercially. And that's where I began to see that you know, something had changed in the industry about the way software was built. I mentioned I was in the computer-aided design tools space. The other thing that my particular group at Stanford did was software engineering. And so it was a big focus in what we did in terms of quality and tools and how software was built. So I observed that we were getting better software out of the way software was being built in the open on the internet as opposed to what was happening commercially. And I was seeing very long release cycles for the commercial software, you know, with very limited feature or bug fix enhancements. And the bugs would sit around for years and years and years in the commercial software. They were getting fixed instantly in the collaborative community on the internet. And I said, you know, something here has changed. People don't quite realize it yet, but the way we're building software working together on the internet is producing better results than these commercial companies that we're paying a ton of money to. Something doesn't make sense there, and I think some of these companies are in trouble. And that's where I ended up starting a company, VA Linux, right? And our business model was to take software off the internet, package it up. We didn't want to develop a lot of new software, but we were mostly interested in the packaging, configuration, making it easy to use, putting it together into a complete system. Combining that with hardware with the same sort of model. We didn't do a lot of unique hardware design, but we did a lot of packaging and how we assembled things. We put the two together, and being able to deliver an alternative to Sun, a fully supported Unix workstation, but instead of it being proprietary Unix, which is kind of an odd term in that day, right? Everyone thought Unix was open. But we were thinking, this is a proprietary Unix workstation. We were building an open Linux system, an open Unix workstation, where Unix in that sense meant Linux, the GNU toolchain, you know, all of those elements put together. And the quality of software, quite frankly, was you know, better than what you were buying from the Unix vendors.
But why do you think open source or free software is really better? Is it what the developer are nicer guys, or
I think people who use open source are just smarter, so they build better software to begin with.
Yeah, maybe.
No, I mean that's somewhat of a joke, but I think it's the open environment. I mean, think about it. If you're a developer, you're writing code, and you know someone is going to look at that code, you know your peers are going to judge you based on that code, you're going to take a little more care as you release it, right? And the fact that the code is available and empowers people, encourages people to take a look at it. If there are bugs, they can help you find and track those down. One of the first open source projects I contributed to was, I took a version of the, if you're familiar with the Yak compiler generator, there's a version of that that comes from the FSF called Bison. So Bison is the FSF's version of the Yak compiler. So I took a version of that, and I was doing a lot of development in C++ at the time, and I said, okay, what I really need to do is I'd like to take that Bison program, but I really want it in a C++ environment because I wanted to be able to create multiple parsers, objects, all of those pieces. So one of my first experiences with free software was taking Bison and creating an alternative version of it called Bison++, which was a version of Bison designed to not just to build in C++, but also generate C++ parser objects. Okay, and I made this available on the internet, as we do with most open source free software. And people started writing me back, and they'd say, you know, you're an idiot. You used consts here when you should be using static whatever variables, because you're using up all this space in each object. Whereas if you had done it this way, the variables would just be predefined once in the object class, and you don't use as much space in each object instance. And I go, okay, I get that. I know how to build compilers. Oh, okay. I just learned something about C++. That's good. And I'd go back and I'd make this change, right? And then a little while later, someone would send me an email saying, you know, you're an idiot. Look at the way you put this, right? you have to have a little bit of a thick skin. I don't mind somebody calling me an idiot. That's how I learn, right? And that product, that piece of software, got better and better because people criticized what I did. And they told me the right way to do it. right? They thought they were just flaming me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't think they were flaming me. I thought they were helping me, yeah. right? And I took it that way, and I made it a better piece of software. And that never would have happened if that had been a proprietary product inside a company, because they never would have seen that code. They never would have told me how to fix it. And it wasn't that functionally it was broken. It wasn't.
Yeah.
It functionally worked, right? But there were better ways, more efficient, faster, took less memory, all those things, better ways to do what I'd done. And because the code was out there, I learned those ways, and people were able to tell me to contribute to it. And so I think that's a lot of why I think open source produces better software. It's because of it's just open. It's the open model.
In companies, they just have to hit the release date, and so it's okay if it is not that bad. It is bad code.
Yes, and they don't have to show the code to anybody, right? I've gone through this now where a company will bring me in and they'll say, you know, we're interested in releasing a piece of software open source. I'll go, okay, that's great. And we start talking about what it requires for them to do that. And they'll say, oh, well, you know, before we release it open source, we have to clean up the code. I'm like, okay, what do you mean by that? And they go, well, you know, there's a lot of cruft in there. It doesn't look that pretty. And,
it's crappy.
You know, and so you go, okay. And they look at me and go, now this is stuff you're selling people, right? You're selling people this software, and you're embarrassed to show them the code. I have a problem with that. Just think about that, right? I mean, if it's what you're paying for, it ought to be the best. But in fact, they wanted to clean it up before they'd release it for free. Mm. That's a very odd situation, right? You know, the stuff, again, what you would be getting for free was going to be better than what people were paying for, because they wanted to clean it up to give it away. Interesting concept. But I think it's that open model that encourages better quality.
But with open source software, if I am a developer releasing all for free, I don't earn money. So how do I do that? I mean, maybe...
How do you make a living or a business out of this, right? Well, look, I'm a firm believer in software as a hobby, and there's a lot of that clearly out there, and a lot of open sources come because people enjoy doing it on their own. They sort of scratch their own itch, as we call it, right? But let's not lose track of today. An awful lot of open source and free software developers today are paid to do what they do. They've made very good livings out of it, and there's a couple ways to think about that. One is just that there are companies today that make businesses off of things like Linux and need to support it. There's been some great, some companies there. You take IBM, for example. IBM has a great business off of Linux. They've invested a ton of money there. And they also have a great business off of all the Apache Software Foundation projects. And in return, they've hired and they pay people to support that. We were talking about Google earlier. Google's built an immense business off of free software. They never would have been able to build Google.com if they couldn't leverage free software. Okay, and because of that, they want to give back. They want to assure that the code they build on continues to develop. And so they give away a lot of free software. I think we heard from Chris DeBona this morning, 18 million lines of code. Right? So that's an example. Example at Sugar CRM. Okay, we have built a business around a piece of software, customer relationship management, solving a big business problem, which we release an open source version of that project. But we also have a commercial version that we sell to companies that are sort of ready for the commercial version of that. They don't want to be in the self-support business anymore around open source. They want someone to just take care of them. That want particular commercial features that we deliver around our professional enterprise products. And that enables us to better support open source.
But what should I do if I have an idea, want to give code to the internet in open source, and want to earn money with it? Are there some steps I need to do to be as open as I can but earn money?
Sure. Look, if you're an entrepreneur and you're looking to build a piece of software, and you know, you're comfortable with an open source model, but you want to preserve your ability to potentially make a business around that, there's things I advise people all the time. You know, one of the things you have to remember is that even though it's open source, you still own that intellectual property. And I think sometimes that's lost in a discussion of open source. Just because you have enabled other people to use it, you've enabled the source code to be visible, there's still a lot of value in the fact that you own the copyright on that code, that you wrote it, that you know how to develop it. So make sure as you release that and you develop, you keep track of, if you get contributions back from someone, you have to keep track of where those came from and make sure you're allowed to take those in so that you preserve your rights around the product you've written, right? And that's very friendly to the open source world, yet preserves your rights as a developer in terms of what you might do and how you might build a business around that. So that's one thing, sort of preserve that right. Another thing is brand matters a lot here. Own your brand, own your trademarks. Okay, that's another thing I advise people. When you're naming a project, think about how that name becomes valuable to you. And you know, I think those are good things. If you take someone who is contributing back and has written, or someone who's developing their own project, I think they should have the advantages of owning their brand and owning their code, because they're giving the rest of us a great, you know, solution, a great piece of software, and they're not asking many money from us. You know, the least we can do is give them those rights back, and also the recognition. I'll tell you, that's another thing that I think is incredibly important here. You know, we used to jokingly call it ego dollars, right? You know, there's you can pay with money, mm-hmm. or you can pay with recognition. And that's why I always strongly encourage, you know, recognizing the developers here, recognizing people that have written that software, right? I mean, that's some of the way you kind of pay back for it. And I think that's very important as well.
And what's with building app a community? So is this also a step I need to do, or right?
Yeah, so one of the things, look, if you're going to be open source, you're going to release the code out there, you want to make sure you take advantage of that. That is, you put yourself in a position where that becomes a benefit to you. And I've seen this all the time. I occasionally see developers who post things open source. But when someone comes back and criticizes them or gives patches or gives feedback, they just brush them off. You know, they don't encourage it. They don't bring it back. And I've seen many of this where what could have been great projects were just killed because someone wasn't accepting of that feedback, right? I'll tell you, you know, anything you put out there, you're going to find people that care enough to tell you, give you feedback. Be accepting of it. Like the example I gave, literally people would email me, you know, with, you're an idiot. Those would be the first three words, you know, in a message that proceeded to go on and tell me how to do something. Well, if you're going to stop it, you're an idiot, and throw it away, you're never going to learn things. You have to have somewhat of that thick skin. You have to be willing to accept that criticism and feedback. And I encourage people to be open about that, you know, to encourage that feedback, encourage the discussion, and you'll take those same people that, you know, you'd be surprised. 6 months, a year later, you'll find those people praising you in public, right? Because you listened to them, you know, and you didn't let the fact that you know, their kind of their first reaction was to flame you for something, you didn't let that get to you. So I encourage people, you know, you want to build an open community, you want to have an open dialogue there, and you have to be receptive. You have to be willing to accept criticism, accept patches, and encourage the people that do give back to you.
What will be the future like? What will be in 10 years maybe, or just next year with open source? Where are the next big things, for instance?
So one of the things I've been talking about lately is the fact that open source is moving into all types of software for us, not just operating systems, not just compiler tools, not just tool chains, editors. If you look today, I mean, open source has made it all the way to sort of real end user applications, right? And that's a trend that I've been watching for a number of years, I'm not sure everyone in the open source community quite gets that yet or quite sees it yet. And certainly not all the end users see it yet. There's still a lot of skepticism, I think, around business applications, for example, as open source. But, you know, we have things like CRM, Sugar CRM today, but, you know, ERP, business intelligence, you know, things that you kind of look around a traditional open source world, you know, open source community, and people kind of go, you know, what is that stuff, right?
I mean, why do you need that?
You know, business intelligence, what? You know, when was the last time, when was the last time you went to a university, you know, compiler class and everyone was going, oh, I can't wait to write some good BI software, you know? But the fact is that's happening. There are BI geeks building really interesting business intelligence software, right? You know, we have CRM geeks building really interesting CRM software. And part of that is open source becoming accepted in all these different areas. Part of it is that people are looking for interesting ways to contribute around open source. And, you know, guess what? Those are the software areas that need the most open source contribution. Okay? So people tend to migrate there. So we see that. And I see a lot of that, and I think that that's going to continue. You know, related to that...
I think cloud computing is also such thing where open source is now moving into.
I think cloud computing is very exciting for open source. Okay, if you look at what's happening with cloud computing, we would not have cloud computing today if it were not for open source. Take Amazon Web Services, for example. Okay, Amazon could not have built that if they had to go to traditional proprietary software and pay traditional proprietary software licenses, because those licenses were not designed to enable incremental business. Those licenses were designed, you know, to buy, you know, a big server license. They weren't designed for the person, you know, using 1 hour of compute time in a week. They didn't price that way, and they never could have gotten there. But they were able to build that system out of open source. So that's one thing. Open source has entirely enabled the cloud. But further, as you look at what people are using on the cloud, they're using open source. One of the things about open source is you need to have a place to run it, right? You need to actually use it somewhere. And, you know, so many machines that you buy today come, you know, so many, you know, you buy a Dell or other box, it comes with Windows. And there's a sort of this number of boxes becomes a barrier, and getting a box becomes a barrier. Well, with cloud computing, it's easy to get a box. You go to Amazon and, you know, you go to Amazon Web Services and I have a box running. It's an IP address now. It's a virtual box, right? It's a virtual server sitting out there, but it was really easy for me to get access to that server, and I'm going to put a server on the internet anyway. What that does is it gives me an easy way to have a playground. So if I want to try out a piece of software, I can spin up a server on Amazon Web Services instantly. I can install some piece of open source code, and I'm off and running. And what that does is it just proliferates and encourages the use of open source. So cloud computing, there's two things going on there. One, cloud computing, open source is enabling cloud computing as the infrastructure and the platform. And two, cloud computing is further enabling the adoption and usage of open source. And the two of those just grow on each other and accelerate each other.
But we still need a really open source stack from cloud computing. I mean, Amazon isn't all open source. It's maybe enabling, but yeah, the technology itself isn't. Isn't that the problem?
Well, the technology in itself is that Amazon is built on is open source.
Yeah, but
they haven't necessarily released all of their code to do everything, right? But in fact, they have built on open source, and you know, there's a lot of things you see out in the cloud that are not open source, and even worse than that, one of the things that scares me about some of the cloud computing offerings is the fact that the many of the SaaS vendors and cloud vendors, they control your data.
Yeah.
Right. So you put your data into the cloud, and you can't get it back. Yeah. Or when you get it back, it's in a format that's less useful than the data you put it up there. Right. So
you
it's
have,
very important.
You have a vendor lock-in.
You have vendor lock-in from that, right? But, I mean, what's worse? The fact that you don't have the source code to an app, or the fact that you don't have your data anymore? I mean, in some ways, that's scarier. And it bothers me, I think, when I see open source advocates often give a free pass to cloud services that lock up their data. And to me, that's worse than not being open source, right? Because if it's not open source, at least you have your data and you have the opportunity to build something around it. If you don't have your data, what do you do? And this is part of the reason, it's part of our philosophy at Sugar CRM, that for our customers, it's their data, and we're very open about the data. And we run our product both as a software, as a service, but we also allow our customers to run it on-premise. And they can start software as a service in our data center. They can move that database to their own servers on-premise anytime they want. Right, so we are making sure that our customers have full access to their data. They can move it around however they want, and they can actually get a real database dump of the data should they decide to take that on premise. And that's very important to us. And I think that that's something people need to watch out for with software as a service and cloud.
Yeah, I hope other companies will do that as well, so that the customer can look at it and say, okay, we take this product, but I'm not finished with it.
Yes, and people just have to think about that. When you put your data out there in the cloud, what does that mean? Who has access to your data? But can you get it back yourself?
Okay, thank you very much. We're running out of time. Thank you, Larry Augustine. Thank you for having you here. And a great day on the Linux Tech. It's just one day. You are here?
I'm just here one day today, but it's a great discussion. Thank you for having me. It's a great, great, great show at Linux Talk.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ciao.